want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. In a moment, we'll meet a new writer named Alice Goffman. She's written a powerful book called On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City, and she gives voice to young black men, the kind we hear about after they've had an altercation with the police and maybe even been shot at or killed. Alice Goffman spent 6 years in inner city Philadelphia, and she captured all kinds of incidents, statistics, and information that I think you'll find fascinating. And first and foremost, she helps address the question, why do young black men run from the police? She's got some pretty good answers. This program's made possible by the financial support of listeners like you, and people like Gary Washington, Bob Donjacour, Andy Krieger, and Chris Welsh. They're all monthly subscribers. I'd like you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. There's a link under my picture that says sign up. You click on that, it takes you to a page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers from anywhere in the world earn a gift from me. It's an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. Thanks for listening. And I hope you'll share this important artist and author, Alice Goffman, with your friends and loved ones.
Gotta never take work off. Maybe I got a plan. Run away fast as you can.
Run away from the baby. Run away. Run away from the baby.
Kanye West opens our podcast today. The song is called Runaway. And there's a powerful new book written by Alice Goffman called On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. And I think this is a very important book that brings voices that you will never likely hear in the mainstream media talking about what life is like in the inner city of Philadelphia. Alice Goffman was a student at the University of Pennsylvania when she first met the people who she covers in excruciating detail in her book. When I say excruciating, I mean that there is a lot of fact and detail that she brings to bear. The number of times that she saw police raid in a specific block. She kept very careful account of what she observed. And Alice, I want to welcome you to the program and congratulate you on this powerful book, On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City.
Thanks so much, Peter. Great to be here.
Now, I want to recap a little bit about the history of Philadelphia and rogue police operations, because I'm a person who believes that Mumia Abu-Jamal did not kill Daniel Faulkner and does not deserve to be serving a life sentence. He did get off death row, and that's a bit of an achievement. But Mumia, to me, is an icon of what is wrong with law enforcement, particularly in the black community in Philadelphia. It was 30 years ago last week that the Philadelphia police launched their massive assault on the MOVE community, and there was loss of life, and it was a real tragic misuse of law enforcement operations. Frank Rizzo, who was police chief and then became mayor, is still considered an icon to the white community in Philadelphia. And as we speak, it was just a few days ago that there was the train wreck, the Amtrak commuter train in Philadelphia that is still unsolved. But issues related to the minority community have been raised. And so Philadelphia is a city with very serious problems, and you have exposed them in a very important way in this book. Tell our listeners a little bit about your methodology, because in some ways I would compare it to the Oscar-winning film Boyhood that was 12 years of covering, you know, a specific group of people. But you spent, what, about 6 years observing this this group in Philly?
Yeah, that's right. It was a 6-year study. And, you know, to that was a great history of Philadelphia policing. I think as we're having this conversation, Philly is also in the middle of another scandal about police corruption and forcing people to testify and planting evidence. And then there was also a report a couple weeks ago by the Justice Department on the Philly PD on just the use of violence, not violence in general, but of gunshot violence. And
well, and since you mentioned that, I was going to bring it up in a bit, but I saved the clipping from a couple of weeks ago. Police officers in Philadelphia have shot at people an average of nearly once a week over the past 7 years. And this comes as tensions linger over the death of Brandon Tate Brown, an unarmed Philadelphia man who was killed by police last December. 59 unarmed people were shot by Philadelphia cops since 2007, which accounts for about 15% of the total number of shootings. So the Philly cops shoot at will and shoot to kill, it appears.
Yeah, and I believe 80% of the people that they're shooting at are black men. So I think that when I was writing this book, I wasn't trying to write a book that was against Philadelphia. I really love Philadelphia. It's where I'm from. It's where I was born and raised. I was really trying to write a book about what the police are doing across America, kind of using Philadelphia as one example. But I do think Philly has a particularly disturbing history of police violence and corruption and all of this that you just beautifully described. So this project, it started out as a senior thesis in college. I'm an ethnographer, which means the close-up observation of everyday life as people live it, kind of like immersion journalism, but the sociology version of that. Mm-hmm. And it started out, I was in a class as an undergrad where we were supposed to go out and study the city. And I took a job at a cafeteria on campus. And there I got to know my boss, who was an African-American woman in her 60s, who managed the basement cafeteria. And then the following year, my sophomore year of college, I started tutoring her two grandkids. And that was the first time I had been to, part of Black Philadelphia, I guess. It was the, as I walked up to her house, which was not actually that far from the university, but Penn is nestled in this historic African-American section of the city. So as I walked up to her house, someone asked me if I were a cop or a caseworker, because there was no other reason why a white woman would be sort of sniffing around.
Well, and Alice, let me confess that when we connected on Skype, I was expecting to see an African-American woman. your book, maybe I missed a detail about your own racial makeup, but the voice in your book is fairly neutral, and I assume that in order to gain the confidence of the people that you depict in the book, that you were probably black.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, that's interesting. The whole kind of, there's a lot of issues to be discussed about race and the politics of representation, and I think when a white person writes a book about a black community, it can be problematic in all kinds of ways. And in the appendix of the book, which is kind of a big chunk of in the last half of the book, I go into that in great detail, kind of talking about being a white person, doing a study like this and what that meant, and So you should read the appendix.
Well, you have caught me flat-footed there. I didn't read the appendix, but I certainly read quite a bit of the book and learned a lot about the individuals that you talk about. And let me jump to one of the important takeaways from the book, and that is, why do black men run from the police? Because, Freddie Gray in Baltimore, Walter Scott in South Carolina, depending on which version of the Michael Brown story you believe, he certainly was moving away from the officer at the time he was shot. There are conflicting stories of exactly what was going on. But the central question is, most people, most white guys, I'll put it that way, who encounter the police submit. And they take whatever is coming, and they figure that I'll work this out because I'm going to hire a lawyer and go to court and take care of it. But you offer, I think, a great deal of insight into why particularly young black men run when the police show up. Give us your insights, please.
Yeah, and particularly if you're poor. So the community that I'm writing about, in the book, it's called Sixth Street, and I got to know a number of young men who lived in this neighborhood, and mostly these young men were out of work, trying to get jobs, not really being able to get a job, even though they tried really hard, and some of them had not finished high school, and so I think it's not, you know, when you say like, you know, black men run from the police, we're not talking about all black men here. We're talking about, particular kinds of socioeconomic contexts and racial contexts. And anyway, so, I mean, the first year and a half of the research on Sixth Street, I took very careful note of whenever I saw any contact between police and residents of the neighborhood and wrote down what that contact was. And, so in that year and a half, I watched the police stop people, on the street, search people, run their names, make an arrest or bring people in for questioning every single day with, I believe, 5 exceptions. I saw the police break down doors, chase people through houses 52 times in that year and a half. So I saw helicopters circling overhead, searchlights 14 times in that year and a half. I saw the police punch, choke, beat, stomp on young men after they had caught them and cuffed them. So we're talking about a level of policing that is very intense and unlike what the rest of America is living under, certainly unlike what middle-class white young men and women are living under. So if you go, you know, some minutes away to the University of Pennsylvania, which is almost entirely white and it's an elite private university, the kids there, you know, if the police were doing what they're doing over on Sixth Street mm-hmm. at this campus, if they were stopping kids and searching their pockets, if they were raiding their houses in the middle of the night, you know, a lot of these kids would have felony convictions, but they don't because the police aren't interested in arresting them. So part of understanding the context of why, some black men are running from the police is to understand just the pervasiveness of the police, how the police are coming into neighborhoods like this, looking to make arrests, either informal or formal arrest quotas, to round up young men and put them in jail. That's sort of their job there.
We have communities like the one you describe where essentially it's a foreign military occupation. And they raid at will, and as you described, time after time, they knock down doors. And part of the reason is that there are often warrants, many times for trivial issues, that enable the police to go after somebody. And right. Because African-American males have a much greater contact with the criminal justice system in all its permutations than the average similarly situated white person, the cops always have a pretext to mess with a young black man.
Yeah, so the warrant issue was really something I wrote a lot about, and I was trying to understand. And I think, I think when people hear these stories on the news, it's hard. I think sometimes when you grew up in a community where the police are your friend, and if they stop you, the most they're going to do is like issue you a citation, but probably not even that. It's hard to understand why you would run from the police if you were not guilty of the thing that they are accusing you of, or that they're stopping you for. Like, if you are not guilty, why run? But that's because people don't really understand warrants, and it's not just warrants. So warrants. So there's about 2 million warrants out in the U.S. right now. Most are not for new crimes, but they're for technical violations of probation and parole, failure to pay court fees, also failure to appear in court. So the technical violations are things like failing a urine test, or being out past curfew, or being caught drinking, or being in a place where there are known criminals around. All these technical violations.
And Alice, in some cases, these are criminalized poverty situations where, and we saw this exposed in Ferguson, but it's common elsewhere, where somebody who gets tagged with a fix-it ticket, their muffler, their license plate was expired. They can't pay the fine, and so the fines just keep increasing. And even if they pay it down a little bit, they're still vulnerable to rearrest, and it creates a whole cycle of vulnerability to police action that puts a whole subset of our society in a position where the police can abuse them with a great deal of impunity.
Yeah, so you're arrestable. That's the idea. That's why the subtitle of the book is Fugitive Life, because it's this idea that you're walking around free, but technically, if the police want to, they can throw you in jail, even if you're not convicted of a new crime. So it's not just warrants, though. It's also people living under supervision, people on probation and parole. So there's about 5 million people, or 4.8 million people, under probation and parole supervision right now in the U.S. And, from this neighborhood that I spent time in Philadelphia, it's like if you're on probation and the police stop you, you could violate that probation because of the police stop, because of a new arrest, even if that arrest doesn't pan out. So if you're out past curfew, if you are found drinking, so you don't need to have a warrant. If you're under supervision, if you're on probation or parole, you also may run from the police when they come, because you don't want to catch a violation. And in fact, it's not just the police that you're scared of. It's places the police may come, to make these arrests. So in one point in the book, Alex refuses to go to the hospital when he's very badly beaten because he's just about to finish his parole term. And he knows that if he shows up to the hospital bloody at 3 a.m., the police will say, "You're out past curfew. You were in a fight. You've been drinking. Your parole is toast." And then he goes back to prison. And all that time he spent trying to work off his parole is gone, and he just was determined not to go back to prison, so he didn't go to the hospital even though he was very badly beaten.
Mm-hmm. Now, in addition to these tactics used against these minority communities, the war on some drugs is a major driver of these problems. And in the introduction to your book, you write, "Sixth Street has not escaped 3 decades of punitive drug and crime policy. By 2002, police curfews have been established around the area for those under age 18. Police video cameras have been placed on major streets. In the first 18 months, I spent in the neighborhood at least once a day. I watched the police stop pedestrians or people in cars, search them, run their names for warrants, ask them to come in for questioning, or make an arrest. In that same 18-month period, I watched the police break down doors, search houses, and question, arrest, or chase people through houses 52 times. 9 times, police helicopters circled overhead and beamed searchlights onto local streets. I noted blocks taped off and traffic redirected as police searched for evidence, or in police language, secured a crime scene 17 times. 14 times during my first 18 months of near daily observation, I watched the police punch, choke, kick, stomp on, or beat young men with their nightsticks." Now, this reprises some of the statistics you mentioned a little while ago, but when you put them into such a powerful summary like this, we see that the war on drugs is directed at minority communities, because smoking a blunt is treated much differently than the frat boy who has a couple of bong hits. it's very clear discrimination.
And I think the thing to understand here is that we're actually being harshest on the people who are the least privileged and who are facing the toughest time in life in general. So it's like, it's not just about, you know, we're being toughest. We're asking young people who have the least amount of resources and the least amount of family support and who are in the crappiest schools, you know, we're asking these young people to walk a very, very thin line, much, much thinner than the line I was asked to walk, or any of the kids that I went to college with were asked to walk. And that's just, it's just not fair. And it's led to, you know, these incredibly high rates of incarceration that our country is just beginning to sort of start to try to talk about digging ourselves out of.
Mm-hmm. And you have a whole chapter, number two, devoted to this issue of running from the cops. And you offer this verbatim quote from Chuck, who was schooling his 12-year-old brother. "If you hear the law coming, you murk on them niggas. You don't be having time to think, okay, what do I got on me? What they going to want from me? No, you hear them coming, that's it. You gone, period. Because whoever they looking for, even if it's not you, 9 times out of 10, they'll probably book you."
Yeah, Chuck, he was the older brother of Tim, and he was, Chuck made it all the way to 18 before he got really into any legal trouble, and he was a senior in high school, and he was a kid in the schoolyard a kid in the schoolyard called his mom a crack whore, mm-hmm. and then he pushed the kid's face into the snow, and then the school cops charged him with aggravated assault, mm-hmm. and then he spent the whole rest of the senior year of high school sitting in county jail awaiting the decision on this assault charge. And at that point, his little brother, Tim, who really looked up to him and followed him around, and, you know, Chuck was everything to Tim. Tim stopped speaking. He was just like traumatized by the event and by the loss of his brother. He stopped saying any words. And you know, months later, Chuck came home and most of the charges were dropped. And then he gave himself the goal of coaxing Tim to start speaking again. He would hang out with him on the weekends. He would play video games with him and just sort of gently try to get him to talk. And then once Tim was talking, the next fall, Chuck was driving Tim to school car, and the cops pulled them over, and the car came up as stolen in California. And then Chuck was charged with receiving stolen property, and then in juvenile court, Tim was charged with accessory to receiving stolen property. And at that point, he was placed on 3 years of probation, and that's when Chuck sat his little brother down and said, you know, the stuff that you're reading in the book right now, that mm-hmm. Just started trying to coach him on how to run from the police, because if the police stopped him while Tim was on probation, anything could become a violation of probation and then a trip to juvenile detention. And Chuck was just determined not to let that happen for his younger brother. So he started coaching him like how to spot undercover cars, how and where to hide, how to negotiate a police raid.
You write, "During the first year and a half I spent on Sixth Street, I watched young men running and hiding from the police on 111 occasions, an average of more than once every 5 days. Those who interact rarely with the police may assume that running away from after a police stop is futile. Worse, it could lead to increased charges or to violence. While the second part is true, the first is not. In my first 18 months on 6th Street, I observed a young man running after he'd been stopped on 41 different occasions. Of these, 8 involved men fleeing their houses during raids, 23 involved men running after being stopped while on foot, including running after the police had approached a group of people of whom the man was a part. 6 involved car chases, 2 involved a combination of car and foot chases. In 24 of these cases, the man got away, And in 17 of those 24, the police didn't appear to know who the man was and couldn't bring any charges against him after he fled. Now, let me ask you about the flip side of that. Of those who ran and were caught by the police, did they get beaten up? Did they get extra payback as a result of running?
I'm not sure if they would have been beaten up had they not run. Very often I saw police beating people up after they caught them when people had run. I'd have to think about how to answer that question because I'm not sure if I can say the police are more likely to beat up someone if the person runs. But mm-hmm. certainly many of the people who I knew who were caught by the police were very, very beat up, bloody, swollen lips, swollen eyes, swollen cheeks. You know, when we would go and visit right in the first couple of days that somebody was in jail. And it was just so routine that people often didn't even talk about it afterwards. Like there was a day where I was on Aisha's block, who lived a bit away from the 6th Street neighborhood. And we saw this cop, a man running, being chased by the police kind of pretty slowly, actually. Like it was like they'd been running for a long time, and the police officer caught the man and pushed him down and punched him a couple times. And no one said anything about it after the police put the guy in the car. It was like it wasn't even an event, you know. It was just so normal.
Well, I've seen it on Fox Television on the cop show. You know, if the cameras are rolling, those cameras, you're expected to produce some gratuitous violence as you take down a suspect.
Yeah, and you know, also I remember visiting Aisha's her boyfriend in jail right after he had been caught and right after he'd been taken in, and his face was so bruised and bloodied, like he was having trouble speaking, and we didn't say anything about it. It was like nobody even asked what had happened. It's like we all just knew what had happened.
Yeah. Now, you also describe how some people successfully use false identities and identification to sidestep a police stop. And you write, five times over the 6 years, I observed people stopped by police successfully use the name of another person they knew to be, quote-unquote, clean. And you expand my vocabulary by saying that places where items ordinarily requiring identification can be bought without showing ID, signing one's name, or showing proof of insurance are known as ducky spots. So in the inner city, you can go to a ducky spot and buy a driver's license or other ID that has your picture but somebody else's name? Is it that sophisticated?
It's a slang term in Philly, and it sounds weird when you say it.
Yeah.
I think the point here is that there are so many people with legal entanglements who, if they are stopped by the police, will be seized, that a whole underground market has emerged to cater to the needs and wants of people who are living in this state of legal liminality. Not just IDs to get through a police stop, but underground medical care, people selling clean urine to people who might not otherwise pass their urine tests, probation officers having little side deals going to help people who are trying to stay out of prison. There's just a whole economy around this kind of fugitive living. People denied the basic rights that all of us have, like showing our ID to get into a hotel room, or being able to go to the hospital, or being able to go to our children's school when there's a school play. And, you know, there are people just living in fear of the police all the time. And so, you know, in this neighborhood, there was this market that emerged around all the things that they couldn't get or the things that they needed because of their liminal legal status.
We're talking with Alice Goffman. Her powerful new book is On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. I have a paperback copy from Picador Press. Is it published in hardcover, or did you go straight to paper?
It's published in hardcover with University of Chicago.
Okay. Okay, great. Next, I want to add another term that you helped to expand my vocabulary with. The term is riding. And you described that, broadly defined, to ride...
You're not a hip-hop listener, Peter.
No, I'm not. You can tell that. Broadly defined, to ride is to protect or avenge oneself or someone dear against assaults to person or property. And you say that in 58 of 71 times you watched women learn the news that a son or boyfriend or loved one was a fugitive from the police, and they became riders. So explain this process, and then I want you to talk about the event where you were present when the cops broke in, and they were pretty brutal in their treatment of you.
Yeah, so I think that one of the most surprising things that I learned doing this research and trying to understand what was happening between police and people living in 6th Street and in other neighborhoods adjacent, one of the most interesting things I started to realize was that women are very often put in a position by the police to either inform or risk their own legal consequences. So the police are there looking for the men in their lives, but along the way, one of the techniques that they use to round up enough men to make their stats, to satisfy their superiors, is to get women to provide information about where men are, what they've done. So, yes, exactly. And so, and women often do not want to play this role of snitch or informant against the very men that they love the most. And it's only the men that you love the most that you can really play this role for, because those are the men whose whereabouts and activities you actually know about. So it's this kind of horrible position that women are in, and what the police do to convince women, it's not just raids, but it's also interrogation. So, you know, in a home raid, you know, it's late at night. It could be a battering ram. It could be the police banging down the door. Police are in SWAT gear sometimes, and they tear the house apart. You know, what's on the cabinets is on the floor. Glass is shattering. They're pulling the ceiling, the drop ceiling out. They're pulling. They're cutting off the cushions on the couch. And while they're doing this raid, they tell women that they can be evicted because the house is unfit to live in, or they will be, the landlord will revoke their lease if they're renting, or their children will be taken from them. The police will call Child Protective Services and have their children taken away because they're harboring fugitives, or they're resisting or interfering with an arrest, or these kinds of things.
There's also the Section 8 rules where they can interact with HUD and...
building, then they can be evicted for harboring a fugitive, interfering with an arrest pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So women when they hear that when you hear that, like, your son or your partner or your cousin has a warrant and that the police might be coming, very often women's first reaction was like, you know, I'll do everything I can to protect him. You know, like, they can't just keep taking our brothers and our sons to prison. You know, like, they can't just keep rounding up the young men in our lives. But then the police would begin their techniques of persuasion. They would raid women's houses, interrogate women, threaten them with all kinds of things. And then slowly they would break women down to the point where women would start to see the reason of cooperating, or start to just feel like they were risking too much themselves. And I think, you know, a lot of people wonder what they would do if they were ever put in the position where they had to choose between their own safety and the freedom of someone that they love, you know. But for a lot of us, it's a hypothetical question. You know, what the police are doing in neighborhoods like this is making this an actual question that people are having to answer over and over and over again. So I think that the resistance to working with police, the resistance to helping the police find men, identify them, you know, it comes out of this feeling like that the police are an occupying force and the police are there to round up the men in your life, and you will not help them do that.
And Alice, it's interesting to me because the police and the prosecutors have all kinds of legal tactics that they can use to induce or intimidate people into snitching. Yet the biggest problem that I see in law enforcement in this country today is that cops will not snitch on bad cops. And so even as they use all of these efforts to force people who have no protection to turn on one another, we have a much more serious problem of the omerta, the code of silence, among police officers who maintain the blue line at all costs.
You know, I think that police are in a very tough position right now in this country, and they're getting the kind of challenge to what they're doing that they have not gotten in a long time. And I think that there's two things I want to say about that. One is that for 40 years, the entire United States, with some very small exceptions for some people without very much public voice, for 40 years, we have been doing tough on crime. We have been doing zero tolerance. We've been doing lock them up and throw away the key. Republicans and Democrats alike, black and white, have wanted stronger drug laws, steeper sentencing guidelines. Anybody committing a crime should go to jail for a very long time. The whole country was doing this. And the police, you know, what policing became through these decades, you know, the police are doing what we have asked them to do. And now we're starting to not want the police to do this anymore. We're starting to want the police to be less brutal and arrest fewer people. We're starting to want to roll back the drug laws. We're starting to see mass incarceration as Michelle Alexander says, a civil rights issue of historic proportion. And the police are sort of caught in this position where what we've been asking them to do and what they've been doing all this time is all of a sudden, you know, really wrong. And we want to hold them accountable to some other norm, you know? And so I think that it's wrong to, you know, I think that, you know, this isn't a book about a few dirty cops or a few cops who are out of control. This is about a whole policing system that America has built, that has targeted black people, that has created the world's largest prison system, but that both sides of the aisle were behind for a very, very long time. So now that we are ready for change, you know, now that we seem sort of much more interested in reform, in rolling back these very high levels of incarceration, in reforming sentencing, in reforming policing, you know, I think that we need to kind of come together to say, you know, let's do it differently from here on out.
Yeah, but I feel that there is such resistance from the police community. And, you know, what we saw in New York after the Eric Garner case surfaced. And then there was the shooting, you know, the execution-style shooting of two cops that then produced this kind of sympathy backlash where the police, in what I consider to be a very arrogant set of moves, they turned their backs on Mayor de Blasio at the memorials. And more importantly, they basically, I think, just, you know, flipped the bird to people who want an honest evaluation and honest enforcement of the laws, even when the lawbreakers happen to be wearing a uniform. And I accept your summary there of the last 40 years. I would accept many thoughtful people who opposed it from the beginning and opposed the three strikes laws, the war on drugs, and minimum mandatory sentencing. There have been a lot of thoughtful people opposed to that, but you're correct about the general population. And I think that television news and Hollywood entertainment have fueled this sense of vengeance and this sense of righteousness that has enabled a lot of the overreach that's gone on. But coming back to my point, I think that we could correct a lot of the problems between communities and the police who serve them if we did prosecute the cops who break the law. And the refusal of cops to testify against one another, to snitch, is one of the things that protects those who conduct the most egregious offenses, in my view.
I think prosecuting cops is one thing. I think that a more robust reform needs to have a really deep rethinking about the role of police in American life and the role of police in communities of color and who police are actually serving. And we need a rethinking of what the police are actually doing, not just a reining in of cops who are breaking the law, but a change in the role of police in poor communities of color in particular. I think we need cops who, we need a policing system that is about helping people with their problems, not about arresting people. We need a policing system that is categorically anti-racist and nonviolent in its ethos, and that honors the possibility and potential of Black young people and tries to uphold that and support Black young people, through young adulthood and through adulthood. And I think that that is a kind of massive cultural change in how the police are orienting to what they're doing. I mean, right now the police have handcuffs, they have a gun, and they have jail time. You know, police need a whole lot more tools for how to help people. You know, these tools, I don't even know if they should be the last resort. Maybe they should be no resort. But we need, I mean, so I'm certainly not saying that what's happening now is okay. We need a massive overhaul, but I don't think it's at the level of reining in cops who are breaking the law. I think we need new roles for police, and for police to be fundamentally this serving the communities that they're in.
Mm-hmm. All right. I hear that. Now, I promised to ask, I just wanted to...
What did you think of that answer?
That was fine. I want to follow up because I had tagged on to my previous question, your description of the events one night at Miss Regina's house. You said, I had fallen asleep on the couch and so heard the banging in my dream mixed with the title page music from Gangs of New York, which you had been watching. The door busting open brought me fully awake. I pushed myself into the couch to get away from it, thinking it might hit me on the way down if it broke all the way off its hinges. Two officers came through the door, both of them white, in SWAT gear, guns strapped to the sides of their legs. The first officer in pointed a gun at me, asked who was in the house. He continued to point the gun toward me as he went up the stairs. I wondered if Mike and Chuck were in the house somewhere and hoped they had gone. The second officer in pulled me out of the cushions and, gripping my wrists, brought me up off the couch and onto the floor so that my shoulders and spine hit first and my legs came down after. He quickly turned me over and my face hit the floor. I couldn't brace myself because he was still holding one of my wrists pinned behind me. And you go on in this description as a third cop enters the house. But you were not only a witness, but you became a victim of this kind of very brutal, mess them up first, ask questions later. And, you know, they didn't present a warrant. They didn't know who you were. They had no basis to brutalize you in this manner. Yet this seems to be pretty routine in Philadelphia police work.
It's funny. I don't even think about that kind of violence as significant. When I think about the violence that I've seen from police, it's so much targeted to Black men. This is just this is like the collateral damage for a white woman who happens to be in a house. And it was so mild. I mean, nobody punched me. The guy just had his foot over me and was yelling at me and sort of, I felt scrunched down there and it was very scary, but, they really are not interested in white women. They're really interested in arresting Black young men. And I think that, that's the kind of point that I want to be making. I do think, though, that, part of why I wanted to show these kinds of scenes in the book is that our understanding of the police, a lot of it comes from what the papers print, which before Ferguson was very much more pro-police than I think it is now. But at the time I was writing, it was very pro-police. And also from TV and from movies. And I think in TV and movies, the guys like Mike and Chuck that are the focus of this book, they are the bad guys. They are the guys that should be caught and locked up and who have no rights and who shouldn't have any rights. And what the police are doing when you see a police raid on a TV show or in a courtroom is righteous. It's righteous violence. It's necessary violence. The police are the heroes. So I just wanted to show these, describe what the police are doing, you know, from the perspective of the people the police are doing it to, you know, who don't get to be the ones who are the focus of these shows or of a lot of media attention. And what it feels like on the other side is brutal and dehumanizing, and very scary, and makes you really angry.
Mm-hmm. There's much more in your book, Alice, and it's fascinating, and I want my listeners to get your book and read it. But in the interest of balance, I want to take a moment here to talk about Chapter 7, because you describe what you call as clean people. And these are people who manage, despite the environment that they live in, to avoid contact with the cops. And also, one of the challenges is they have to avoid appearing too virtuous or goody-two-shoes because, you know, that can affect their social relationships in the other direction. So talk a little bit about some of the people you profile who are clean and who are able to operate in this situation.
I think, well, the point of this chapter and the point of this line between clean and dirty, it's not a line that I'm trying to draw myself as a researcher, like, okay, here are these two parts of this community. It's the point of that line is that the police, the courts, the prisons are so deeply present in the neighborhood that people are drawing distinctions in moral terms and in kind of practical terms between each other, based on the level, on the risk people have of being arrested. So this people who are not at risk of being arrested, who are working, who are older, who are women, who are going to school, who, you know, who don't have court fees, who don't have court cases, people call people like that clean. And it's the idea that if the police stop you, you'll be able to make it home tonight. You will not be seized and gone for who knows how long. So very often when we heard that a young man was stopped by police, the first question about it was, is he dirty? Which means, like, did he have any drugs on him? Did he have a warrant? Did he have a court fine? Did he have probation? Does he have any legal entanglements that will prevent him from making it home tonight? And so, but this distinction, it's bigger than just in the moment. It's like, you know, some people are leading lives where they have almost no contact with the police. You know, this is a mixed income community. So you have middle class people who are going to school and work every day as their neighbors are being chased down by cops. So how do you live in a neighborhood like that, you know, and go to school and work every day and then deal with the police in your midst and deal with the people who are being chased by them and running from them and going to court and dealing with warrants and this whole kind of world? So it was their perspective that I wanted to show in that chapter. And thanks for mentioning it.
Yeah, I think it's important because we get too many snapshots that lead to generalizations. And like any community, it's complex, and there are many different people who are managing to navigate in one way or another. I wanted to ask you, Alice, President Obama in the last couple of days went to Camden, New Jersey, which is a different state from Pennsylvania, of course.
Right across the river, yeah.
Right. But Camden showed up in Chris Hedges' book as what he described as a sacrifice zone. And Hedges described how after the white flight from Camden, it basically became a feeding frenzy for the cops and the public officials who basically just, harvested what was left, if I can put it that way, and rode the cycle all the way to the bottom. And the president was there to, highlight that there have been changes in policing in Camden. But I want to focus on that term sacrifice zone because I feel that the poverty and the war on drugs have combined to create the sense among many people in power in this country that certain communities should just be written off. And I've heard this in California from conservative politicians who say that, you know, communities like Oakland can't really be fixed. And so we should just forget about this generation, write it off, and somehow hope that things will get better down the road. And it strikes me that in some respects, the 6th Street community that you depict in your book has been declared a sacrifice zone by the powers that be in Philadelphia. So I wanted to get your comment on that and that whole concept and the extent to which the establishment picks winners and losers and just kind of says, well, we can't help the losers and we're not even going to try.
The neighborhood of 6th Street is not a very poor part of this section of the city. It's actually a mixed income that has a lot of middle class families, and it's nicer lawns, nicer houses. It's a neighborhood in decline. But it's not a neighborhood that the police are particularly interested in. And in interviews with them, it wasn't a hot spot. You know, it never showed up in what, like, it wasn't a neighborhood that was targeted as a high crime or a high drug neighborhood. And other sections of this part of Philadelphia were much more interesting to the police in that way. So I think in terms of just how the police saw the neighborhood, it's not a sacrifice zone. You know, we have two parallel things going on in African-American communities, in cities that are poor. Particularly, we have the divestment of business, schools, funding for all kinds of community, you know, works. We have the divestment from welfare support. You know, we have Clinton gutting welfare in 96. So we have the taking, not just doing nothing, but taking resources out of communities. And then we have the bringing in of police and courts and prisons. So we're taking away resources from schools, from work, from supporting families, and we're bringing in law and order. We're bringing in handcuffs and jail time. And both of those things, I think, need to change if we're going to make any real progress here.
So as we wrap up, I want to touch on something that you and I talked about before we started recording. And that is that I'm not particularly optimistic that the recent events will really produce long-term change. I think we will see some adjustments and a lot of things done for public relations purposes. But I explained to you that I've been following bad cops since the late 1960s. And, you know, it comes in waves, and there are periods when it's not as bad as before. But ultimately, I believe that the police and the law enforcement units are given too much authority with too little oversight, and that I don't see anything that is going to change those fundamentals that will lead to the real kind of breakthrough that I think you might be hoping for.
When we talk about being hopeful, I think, you know, my hopefulness comes as a comparison to how hopeful I was when I was writing this book, where, you know, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, had not come out yet. President Obama and former Attorney General Eric Holder had not come out yet on the need to address racial disparity in incarceration, the need to roll back the drug war. We hadn't seen the decriminalization of marijuana yet in different states. We hadn't seen, you know, California roll back 3 strikes. And we hadn't yet seen these declines, these modest declines in incarceration rates in New York, California, and New Jersey. And, you know, mass incarceration, it was like this fringe thing that was not appearing in the mainstream papers. It was like these fringe lefties were talking about it, you know, civil rights activists were talking about it, but it wasn't part of the public conversation. Now we're at a point where, and so for 40 years, every president has increased our incarceration rates. Obama's the first president where we saw those rates go down across the country a little bit. But after 40 years of growth, that's significant. This is the first presidential election where the word mass incarceration is being used, and where, like, I think every candidate now has said that there are too many people behind bars. We've never had this kind of we've never had such a public conversation about the need for criminal justice reform as we're having now, not for 40 years, I don't think. And we've never had bipartisan support for decarceration. So the policing piece, I think I agree with you. I think reforming policing is going to be, which is really the front end of this system, you know, that reforming policing is going to be very, very tough. But sentencing reform, probation and parole reform, this stuff's happening, and it's happening around the country. And I think some of the most exciting conversations I've had this year are with practitioners, with probation officers, parole officers, police chiefs, people who are running prisons, who want less people under supervision, less people in prison, who are trying to address racial disparity. And this is their mission. You know, I'm not saying that the country's full of people like this, but there are some. So I think I'm hopeful compared to where we were a few years ago.
All right. Well, Alice, it's a real pleasure to meet you and talk with you about this book. Again, I recommend it to each person listening today. It's called On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. And our guest is Alice Goffman.
Thanks so much, Peter. Really lovely talking to you.
As usual, I'd like to hear your comments and feedback. Drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.